Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Beautiful day outside, beautiful day inside. How nice is that? We love beautiful days because we get to see all the beautiful people in the world. Clinton, Leslie, Khaki Dimmock is here today. Executive Director Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless.
Good morning.
As we talk about homelessness, not a beautiful topic.
No, but lots of good things happening.
Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless.
Yeah, rolls right off your tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah, is there a short phrase for that?
TJAC. Nobody knows what that is either.
All right, we'll refer back and forth. We are going to talk about homelessness throughout the hour. I was originally earlier in the year trying to do this during the winter because I think during the winter, you know, people, in my mind anyway, I think I do, there's a lot more empathy. You know, it's freezing cold outside. When I originally had this planned, it was the weekend after that huge snowstorm. And I'm thinking, where are these people staying if they're homeless?
Yes. Well, certainly in the winter, there's a kind of urgency about homelessness that increases empathy overall. So we think about people sleeping outside, the very real risk of people dying of exposure in those circumstances, and the fact that there are limited resources in our community and every community. There's no community across the country that says, gosh, we have just way too many shelter beds or way too many emergency shelter services. But we are really grateful and lucky in our community to have PACHM, which is people and congregations engaged in ministry, which provides a very low barrier emergency seasonal overnight shelter. And they just did a Herculean task over that really big snowstorm, asking for volunteers to help, moving their shelter so that they could do walking distance and didn't have to rely on buses to transport folks. PACHM staff actually bought and prepared food for the guests who were staying there that night. And the Salvation Army, during the winter months, maintained an emergency warm room. So when it was below 32 degrees, they would allow someone to come and stay essentially in like a living room area, at least so that they could avoid being outside. So between these two resources and the Haven, which provides day shelter services and stays open in the afternoons when it's below, I think it's 27 degrees, but I'm not sure what their cutoff is. We really did exceptional work in this community over that that emergency weekend. I will say that there was somebody who was living in a tent, sleeping outside during that big snowstorm, whose tent ceiling, the roof of their tent caved in, and they required some emergency assistance from police. And they were able to stay in the emergency temporary shelter that was set up with a combination, like a collaboration between the City of Charlottesville's Department of Social Services and the Red Cross. And on those weekends, all of the services in town really rallied together to make sure that no one dies of exposure on our watch, which is really nice to have that kind of collaboration.
And so despite the cold weather, despite the big snowstorms that we had, and despite any snowstorms that we had, despite the cold weather, there were no homeless deaths that you're aware of in our area.
No, and certainly there certainly have been homeless deaths, but not from exposure. And that's really, if there's a baseline in terms of what a community provides, it generally is that. We don't want someone to die of exposure, and we don't want someone to go hungry. Generally, those are the sort of two sort of baseline services, sort of expectations that communities have. And then, of course, there are lots of other services above and beyond responding to temporary need or emergency need. But this is a community that has said we don't want someone to die of exposure on our watch, and we don't want folks to go hungry, which makes us an empathetic and sympathetic community for folks.
This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm Rick Moore. We're talking about homelessness today. Khaki Dimmick is the guest, Executive Director, Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless. Used to be a top person at The Haven.
They were the same organization then. So The Haven was one of the first three goals of the community plan to end homelessness that was in force when I took the job in August of 2009. There had been a pretty significant need identified for a day shelter in town. The Thomas Jefferson Memorial Library, the regional library downtown, had served as a sort of de facto day shelter. And of course, that's not their area of expertise. And it became clear that there needed to be a day shelter in town. So we, the TJAC, seeded and started The Haven with lots and lots of support from lots of different places. And then 2 years ago, TJAC began the process of separating financially and legally from The Haven, and The Haven has sort of flown off on its own, and now we're just two distinct organizations. So we were one at some point.
Do you think that there's a difference in, I used the word empathy a few moments ago, attention, similar word choice? I was planning to do the show on the homeless back in the winter. It's cold. There's concern about, goodness, I don't want to go outside for, you know, the 5 minutes it takes to go out, get in my car, start it up, and get the heat to a comfortable temperature. How does somebody stay out here all day? And now it's a beautiful day. Does the empathy, does the attention for the topic, for the people suffering from this change? Do the dollar donations go down? Does the volunteerism change?
There definitely is a cycle or a pattern. I think the sort of majority, and this is probably true for most nonprofits in town, so I don't know that it's unique to folks responding to homelessness, but there's definitely a pattern where most donations come in between Halloween and sort of mid-January, and then there's a pretty significant drop-off in late spring in the summer. Thankfully, there are some donors who are aware of that kind of cycle and intentionally I target those months for their particular gifts. And then volunteerism changes. I will say the UVA students provide an incredible service around volunteerism in this community, particularly at The Haven and with other homeless organizations. And there certainly is a shift in May as the students go to their fantastic summer plans. But usually the community members, non-student community members, really respond to that. And if they weren't available during the school year, they become available in the summer. I think there's a visibility issue as well in the summer. If someone's camping out, if someone's sleeping outside, they tend not to be as visible around the community. And so they're sort of hiding in the woods in some ways. And so there isn't the kind of sense of urgency as when you see somebody who is in need in front of you all the time. So there's definitely a cycle. And there's a cycle to all of our lives, right? People are really occupied with themselves in the summer. What are we going to do for the summer? Where are we going to go? Those kinds of plans, issues, distractions for us. But
talking about homelessness with Khaki Dimmick, Executive Director at TJAC, Coalition for the Homeless here in the Thomas Jefferson area. I did a show at the previous life of Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with Stephen Hitchcock from The Haven. And the focus on that program was about the people who are asking for money at the stoplight intersections. What effect do you think those folks have on homeless people who do not ask for money at the intersections? Because when you get into a conversation with others, whether you're whether you're sitting down for lunch with a coworker, whether you're at a party talking, you know, and there's certainly sides to that story about those people are just grifting. They're just trying to get my money. They don't need money. And then there are those who you can see, however far back you are at the stoplight, who are handing money over or something. I've seen them give coats. or other packages. Your thoughts on that?
I think there couldn't be a more sort of complicated question around panhandling and the way it makes us feel, why it makes us feel like that. Not all homeless folks are panhandlers, and not all panhandlers are homeless. But they get associated with each other, and there certainly is a strong set of opinions around panhandling. I think it upsets people, and I've done a fair amount of thinking about this, and I will say that I'm begging, which is what panhandling is a really cultural, it gets interpreted through a cultural lens. There are other countries in the world where begging is a noble activity, where it's a spiritual activity in some communities, where Buddhist monks beg for the food for their day, and there's great pleasure in being able to provide for those folks. There are other communities where begging really elicits a strong sense of concern. In Japan, there's a really big focus on if you don't have that other people have and they should give, there is very little strong sense of sort of negative perception of somebody. So I do think it's there's a cultural lens with which we view panhandling or begging. And at the root of it, it's a strong sense that somehow somebody's getting something they don't deserve, or pulling the wool over our eyes, lying to us, that they didn't work hard enough for it, or that and the reverse of that coin, of course, is the assumption that everyone, if they work hard enough, should be able to make ends meet in this country, which I think is foolhardy thinking. I think that we know now that the deck is stacked against a fair number of people in our community for a variety of reasons, and that, in fact, after this most recent housing crash, that tragedy and poverty and emergency sort of financial crisis can affect a huge range of folks. And so the assumption that somehow somebody's panhandling and is part of some sort of panhandling ring, or that somebody's sort of a mastermind making tremendous amounts of money, really impacts people's view of somebody who's simply asking for something extra you have at the stoplight. On the other hand, panhandling is also a successful strategy if you don't have any income. And so you said that you've been in the stoplight and been able to see $5 bills go out the door, out the window for somebody. It works because there's a tremendous number of people in this community who are giving. And they're giving in that moment because they feel guilt, or they feel care, or they feel compassion. For whatever the reason, standing on the corner with a sign is clearly something that's an effective strategy for getting a little flexible, unrestricted income for somebody. So there's a lot of anger, I think, and frustration over the panhandlers. But in fact, this is a community that's supporting that activity for a variety of reasons. And I think they're all complicated. It's just an incredibly complicated soup. And there are some folks we know who are panhandling in the community who pool their resources together to get up one hotel room. And if they don't have enough together for that hotel room, they all sleep outside together. That kind of cooperative, mutual aid kind of community sharing is something we would applaud in almost every other context. But when people see that they're working together, there's a stronger sense of it, somehow that it's unjust, or that this cooperation proves that they shouldn't need to beg. So I think it really affects people strongly. And my ultimate conclusion is that it affects people strongly because it is an in-your-face reminder that some people have stuff and other people don't.
I will say that when I did this show, and it's been a year and a half, or maybe even 2.5 years now, with Stephen Hitchcock from The Haven, and I did it because there was an article that had been written for the Siva Weekly, and I believe the journalist's name was Jordy Yeager.
Yep.
Jordy Yeager. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember whether it was Stephen or Jordy who had said that the way that they had come to determine who was a true homeless person and who was a grifter was who was out there in the bad weather. If you drove your route, went through the intersection on a regular basis, and you saw this person out there on a nice day like today, and then you saw them out there when it was raining horribly, when it was snowing, when it was 15 degrees out there, when it was 95 degrees out there, when it was miserable and all you wanted to do was sit in your car until you got home and not go outside again. You didn't want to put your window down to give them anything.
Mm.
But that person was out there. That person was in need.
Mm.
But when that person wasn't out there on a bad weather day, then that person probably wasn't in need. Although they certainly could be injured or some other, you know, it's not always so easy to just draw the line.
Absolutely.
But that was how Stephen or Jordy had made their determination on that the people who were really in need, they couldn't take the day off because the weather was bad, too cold, too wet, too hot.
Mm. That's an interesting sort of division or assessment. I will say that I think, you know, as you say, need is really difficult to define. And, you know, when we're talking about homelessness, that's a different kind of need than chronic poverty. But there are a tremendous number of people in our community who may be housed or maybe sleeping in their cars or sleeping in somebody's basement room or a garage, who are really struggling to make ends meet, to pay off court fines, to save money for their first month's rent, or to just get enough money for them or their kids to eat. And so I think that there are some folks who panhandle who are not homeless, who are facing the scrutiny of the general public by standing in the median with a sign asking you to give them money. That is not a comfortable position for anyone in the world to be in. People know what people are thinking about and saying about them in their cars. They know when you're avoiding making eye contact with them. They hear the worst things come out of those windows at the same time that every other car gives a $5 bill. There are plenty of people who are yelling really ugly things at fellow human beings who, in their desperation, are forced to go outside and say, I need something from you because I don't have enough. Yes, there's probably somebody out there who doesn't need it as much as the other folks. There's probably somebody out there who is grifting, as you say. But the vast majority of people who are facing the possibility of begging in America understand what that means. They understand the judgment and the difficulty that people will have with them making that choice. That's not a comfortable position for anybody. And if anyone has dressed in the Liberty Tax suit to stand outside or with a gorilla suit to sell mattresses, it is hard to stand up in the middle of being exposed outside all day asking for anything, no matter what. That's difficult work.
I once dressed as Santa alongside Route 29 down near Levinston.
Excellent.
That's a little different. I got a lot more positive horn toots,
yeah, exactly,
than probably a lot of other folks.
That's right. There's good feelings about Santa generally.
Yeah. 11:20 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with Khaki Demick, talking about homelessness. We'll come back. We're going to talk about Charlottesville. We'll talk about some other cities. Not everybody is doing it the positive way. Some doing it through anti-homeless legislation. Hang tight. And a beautiful day with the weather outside. Hopefully you're enjoying it while you're enjoying us. Khaki Demick and I, Executive Director Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless, TJAC. Yeah, you really need to work on
a catchy thing.
Yeah. So let's talk about what Charlottesville is doing. Do comparatively, let's start in the state of Virginia. Does Charlottesville have a noticeable, or did, because I know that the homeless population has changed in the last decade, but how noticeable, good or bad, was Charlottesville's homeless population?
The number of folks who were experiencing homelessness in our community 5 years ago, 10 years ago, pretty consistent with the average number of folks per population in Virginia and across the country. I think you As a sort of small city, we have a small city that thinks of itself as a rural town. I think we have probably more homeless folks than people are comfortable with seeing out there, and significantly less per population than some more urban areas like Richmond or in Northern Virginia, or in places where a tremendous number of veterans live.
Well, I would think that it would be... it would be difficult to be homeless in Charlottesville for an extended period of time because it's not, it's just not big enough of a town, is it?
Well, there's not, it's not a variety of resources, right? So we have one year-round shelter for the homeless. We have one low-barrier seasonal shelter. We have one day shelter. But we do have a number of resources and all of the kinds of programs that you might see in a larger community. So we have street outreach teams, we have transitional housing, and we have a variety of permanent supportive housing programs. We have some short-term rental assistance programs, and now we have a fairly robust homelessness prevention program. So we have the full continuum of care that you might expect to see in like San Francisco or LA, Chicago, but we don't have a variety of resources in each one of those categories, and so we have one program doing it. But while there is certainly movement and transience among the homeless population, in general, the homeless population doesn't move around a lot. And so the vast majority, and this is true in almost every community except for Florida, San Diego, and Hawaii, where these rules don't apply. For the vast majority of homeless folks come to a place because they have family, friends, or a job there. And so they're already connected there. And every time we do the research locally, we find between 75 and 80% of the homeless folks who are receiving services have a hometown in the Thomas Jefferson area. So that's the five counties and the city of Charlottesville. And so hometown, right? So in some ways, the homeless population here is more local than the general population in Charlottesville, right? So there isn't, even if somebody would, someone who was experiencing homelessness would say, gosh, there's such a great homeless system in Memphis. I'm just going to get myself to Memphis so I can take advantage of that system. It's just not the way it works for the vast majority of folks. They stay where their people are. They stay where their job opportunities or community are. And at some point, they stay someplace where they don't have any choices about moving anyway. So we're pretty average in that kind of way in Charlottesville, except for the fact that we have responded with some compassionate focus and made sure that we have resources at every step along the continuum.
So when you send me an email, as we discuss today's show, that says locally, our Charlottesville area, locally our numbers are going down over the last 5 years, my reply is, how are we sure this is not from people being chased away? Well, I mean, that's one of the questions. It's also the follow-up, you know, or the other part of that question is, tell me all the great things that we're doing to help.
I'm so glad you asked.
But it sounds like people being chased away, they're not. They're not, or even if they felt that they were, they're not leaving because that's not part of the, that's not part of what happens traditionally.
That's right. That's right. People generally don't move to town homeless. They come here not homeless, either returning to family or friends or coming for job prospects, and then they become homeless while they're here. And for some people, they've been homeless for a lot longer. They've sort of grew up in some ways homeless here, and they can't remember a time in their adult lives in which they've had a fixed residence. But they're from here. And so our numbers are going down. Our numbers are going down pretty steadily in almost every subcategory for the last 5 years.
Subcategory?
So if you think about subcategories being the count that we have from the variety of services we have, but also folks who are chronically homeless, which is a specific designation that is reflects somebody who's been homeless for an extended period of time and plus has a documented disability. And so generally we think of the chronically homeless as being the sort of backlog in homelessness. It's evidence that for a long time in this country, we didn't respond very well to homelessness. We responded solely to people's basic needs, but we didn't help in any kind of transformative way to move somebody out of homelessness into a state of non-homelessness, right? And so,
you mean explain this to me, because the image I'm getting is we gave more money to the food you know, so that there were, we could feed more people daily who were homeless, but we didn't give them a place to live. We just made sure that they, that more of them could get their lunch meal.
That's exactly right. So we responded, and this is, this reflects a really significant change in practice around homelessness across the country over the last 10 years that certainly has played out here locally as well. But for the longest time, we responded to homelessness through compassion. And so we said, we see somebody who does not have clothes, we'll provide clothes. We see someone who is hungry, we'll feed them. We see someone we're worried about dying of exposure, we'll make sure that they have a safe place to be, particularly in the winter months. But those things are not transformative. They provide, they make sure that somebody's basic needs are met, but they don't actually help somebody change the circumstance.
Why isn't that transformative?
Well, it's certainly transformative in the moment, but if you're living day to day, you don't know where your next meal is coming from, or you don't know where you're going to sleep that night, you're living in a state of a housing crisis all the time. Your capacity to plan for a future, whether that's financial or emotional or relational, your capacity to do that is limited by the fact that you're trying to just focusing all day, every day on meeting your basic needs. So if you, for example, stay at Pacham, which is a really wonderful low-barrier shelter during the seasonal months that it's open, you get up at 6 o'clock in the host church, and then you might be transported by a volunteer driving a jaunt bus back to the Haven. The Haven opens at 7. Then you have breakfast at the Haven. You might stand in line or get in line to take a shower, and then you might actually have to do some laundry, in which case you might sign up to do laundry. That's going to take up several hours of your morning, if not the whole morning. And then you have to walk to where the free lunch is at the soup kitchen and be there for an hour and then walk back to wherever you might spend the afternoon. If the Haven's open, you go back there. If you're staying at Pacham, you need to be back at the Haven at 5 o'clock in order to get in line to make sure that you have an overnight safe place to spend the overnight. You might have 2 hours that are your own that day. The rest of that time, you are focused on trying to make sure you eat, shower, and have a safe place to sleep. So you don't have a lot of time or emotional energy to spend any time thinking about what's next, right? So you get caught in this sort of emergency, crisis-driven trap where every day you wake up and meet your basic needs, you don't have the capacity to be thinking about the future. So there needs to be something else that's offered. And there's the radical transformation in this country that's happened over the last 10 years has been this incredibly obvious, stupid, and radical idea that homelessness is a housing crisis. And to solve homelessness is to solve the housing crisis. And so there needed to be a tremendous amount of research to find out what works. How can you house homeless folks rather than just providing temporary shelter? What does it mean? What do we need to do to provide additional services? And it turns out, like all things, there's a variety of kinds of solutions for a variety of kinds of problems. But some folks just need a couple of months of somebody's paying their rent for them to get back on their feet so they can begin to plan and invest in their future because they're out of that emergency crisis-driven sort of short-term trap. And so that's a big shift.
94.7 WPVC, learning about homelessness with Khaki Demick here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, and learning things that you think are, you know, sounds like it would be easy, and then things that make your mind, what's that commercial where you go poof, and the top of your brain blows off.
That's right.
We keep talking about, I noticed that religion keeps popping up in all these discussions. You know, for those who don't know, Pacham is an organization of churches that sort of like take turns hosting and caring for the homelessness throughout the colder months of the year. The Haven, obviously, built in an old or taking in an old church.
Salvation
mm-hmm. Army. And why is that? Must you be religious to care about people who don't have a home?
Certainly not. I think compassion and care comes in all kinds of packages. But there are very many people who are driven by their faith to serve the homeless. I think that driven by faith to do good works, not just think good thoughts, but actually operationalize your belief or your values. And that group tends to also benefit from the organizational structure of churches, in which there's somebody who says, we ought to volunteer in our community, we ought to respond to community needs, and here's how we're going to do that as a collective. The power of that group as a collective to provide these basic services, like provide meals, serve meals, plan them, host Pachem, and provide the sort of incredible volunteer support that the Haven receives, is really miraculous. It's kind of amazing that this particular group shows up in that kind of way. And I do think that it's because there is this strong sort of stated belief in living your values. But that's not unique or specific to those who are motivated by faith. We have certainly lots of other folks who come as well.
11:32 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Kaki Demick, Executive Director, Coalition for the Homeless, 94.7 WPVC. Kaki, we're talking about what Charlottesville has done, and I want to get back to a few more specifics, but other areas around the country are sort of doing the opposite. Mm-hmm. They are, you mentioned how homeless typically stay in the area where they've grown up, they don't leave, but other areas are indeed chasing the homeless away. Maybe not out of the city, maybe they're just forcing them to be more mobile, but they are putting together anti-homeless legislation.
Absolutely. I think the homeless challenge us in so many ways, right? They challenge our belief systems, our sense of how much there is to go around. They challenge the sense of who's deserving that we talked about earlier. And in some communities, there is this strong sense that there's the crisis or the desperation and need of the homeless population outstrips their capacity to respond. So there's two things. One is the homeless need so much, and people are fearful or overwhelmed by the level of that need. And then there's the second sort of belief that there's not enough to go around for everybody, and so we have to be selective about who gets our good resources. I don't happen to believe in that. I think that there's plenty to go around, and if we figure out the right distribution method, everybody can be okay. But there are certainly communities who are based on this, what I consider a scarcity model, saying we don't have enough and they need too much, and we have to figure out a way to manage that. And I think that what that reflects is a sort of tipping of the scales, where you're not allowed to sit on sidewalks, or people remove every bench in the community, or you're not allowed to sleep outside, or there's the sort of anti-loitering kinds of legislations that's sort of geared towards the homeless. And the National Alliance on Homelessness has a worksheet on the sort of criminalization of poverty, which is what that essentially is, a criminalization of extreme poverty, which really seems like the worst possible response to people who are in desperate need, who cannot take care of themselves. And as a community, we certainly reflect, Charlottesville reflects a compassionate community in which we've said that's not the way we want to respond. And communities have an obligation to meet the needs of all of its citizens, not just those who are in extreme need, but everyone. And so if people are fearful, then we have to figure out a way to make sure that they feel safe. And if people feel like they're not, you know, that people aren't going to patronize their businesses, they're not going to come down and buy stuff at a shop because there's homeless folks outside, there needs to be a way to sort of balance the responses to make sure that we're meeting everyone's needs. But I can't remember. I think it might have been Albert Schweitzer who said, you know, a community will be judged based on its capacity and willingness or method for serving those with the most need in their community. And certainly that's a value that I believe strongly in, and I'm really proud to be in a community that has found a way to strike some kind of balance, and I think is really taking noble and excellent action at making sure that we house people. Through our system of care, we during our annual point in time count, which is when we sort of assess the census, which is a homelessness census we do every year across the country in January, we had identified that our system of care had housed 106 homeless people last year. And those folks were almost all chronically homeless. So people with disabilities who had been on the streets for a very long time. And housing is this sort of no-duh solution to homelessness, but it's also the economic solution to homelessness. It costs in our community for a chronically homeless person, it costs us about $22,000 in the aggregated system of care to keep someone in a state of homelessness for the year. But if we house them in a housing program that has actually supportive services on site, it's less than $9,000 a year to house them. So it's cheaper by half to respond to their basic needs. And they end up paying dividends because once you house someone, they use the emergency health care system and the criminal justice system care dramatically less. So in L.A., I think there was a study that showed that there was a 74% reduction in admissions to the hospital for the year after they house somebody, even if you've done nothing to address the healthcare condition of the person. They just begin to manage themselves and their own issues once you've solved the housing crisis. It just makes sense. It makes sense from a human capacity, and it makes sense from an economic capacity for us to respond to homelessness.
11:37, this is 94.7 WPVC, Sunday morning wake-up call, talking about homelessness. Khaki Demick is here with us. You talk about the cost of housing a someone suffering from chronic homelessness, $22,000. Mm. How does that work in an expensive town, an area like Charlottesville? How does it only cost $22,000 to house someone here?
So actually, it's $22,000 to keep them in homelessness. And so that's the cost of all of the systems that serve them while they're homeless. It's only $9,000 to house them.
And that's what makes me go, no way. Because as someone who is looking for another place to live...
Mm-hmm.
I look every day at the homes for sale, places for rent, apartments of all types. My minimum is set at $1, and that just can't be.
So this is, I will say that there's a small caveat to that, which is that cost is the local cost for housing them. So there is a national cost. And so HUD, which is the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is both a policy and funder around issues around housing and homelessness in our country, HUD will supplement the cost. So if you set up the right kind of project, HUD provides a voucher that helps to offset the true cost of that rental unit. And the $500 becomes the local cost. And then generally that cost is also part of an economy of scale. So if you think about a project called The Crossings, which is at 4th and Preston, that was established by the Virginia Supportive Housing Program, they're national experts based in Virginia around permanent supportive housing. And they know how to develop how many units you have to develop, how much funding support you need from the local community versus the federal government in order to make it work. They're certainly not getting rich off that, but they are really reducing at least by half the overall cost of homelessness for the local community.
Right, and you use the phrase not getting rich off that.
Yeah.
And which brings to my mind how many landowners, building owners, developers in this area are willing to say, fine, I'll not get rich off that. Let me be a helper rather than let me put myself in the right place in my religious faith and walk through and help rather than be the person on the side who's actually bringing the money in.
Well, hopefully you just converted 10 to 15 local developers by that compassionate little speech there, because we do need more developers who are willing to take these risks and serve the needs. We have a significant problem in terms of a lack of affordable housing in our community, not just in Charlottesville. And we have a population that if we want to help them from a compassionate level, but we also want to improve our economic costs for taking care of folks, then it's in our best interest to find affordable housing for all of those folks, including people who are not homeless but living in persistent poverty. So, you know, there are housing organizations like Piedmont Housing Alliance and Habitat for Humanity and Albemarle Housing Improvement Program and Community Services Housing and even Region 10 who are making sure that there are affordable housing programs that are offered for folks in need in our community. But we need more, and we know that the sort of gold standard is private public partnerships, and so it would be really lovely to have some of those. So I think Piedmont Housing Alliance is working really hard right now on planning for a massive redevelopment of Friendship Court, in which they're really looking at how to marry the needs of public-private, mixed-income, mixed-use in our downtown corridor. And I know they're being very thoughtful and methodical about that process, and I look forward to seeing that as a model for other redevelopment projects in our community.
Yes, all you landowners, remember your Bible and when Jesus walked through. Yes, remember where the coins went and who he had faith in. 11:42 here on the Wake Up Call. Tacky Demick with us talking about homelessness. We shall return. All right, back in action. It is a beautiful Sunday. Thank you for being with us here, WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Tacky Demick, executive director. That's quite a title. Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless. Not so much of a good title, but a great project. Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless. You know, this is a topic, homeless, that only gets discussed in local politics. Never seems to make it. The only thing I've heard about on state level, Governor McAuliffe, you know, came out, I guess, maybe on Veterans Day and said that Virginia had zero veterans suffering from homeless anymore. I don't know if that's true or that's a little of those statistics that can be read in different ways. And I haven't heard it as a topic at all in any of the national presidential races, although I'm not sure they've discussed many topics at all.
Well, I will say that, you know, for certainly 50, 60 years of national policy, the official national policy around homelessness was that homelessness was a local issue and required local responses. And I am loath to sort of make any assumptions about their intentions in that. But it took them a long time to identify the very first national goals around homelessness, which we're right in the middle of right now. So President Obama established the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, which was the very first sort of national federal government response around homelessness. And they did two really important things in the world of homelessness. One, they began to study what works and what doesn't work. And for the first time, there was a body of knowledge that allowed local communities to make choices and say, instead of just responding to basic needs, we want to do something that's transformative, and this is the kind of housing program we'll offer. Instead of having everyone just sort of throwing stuff at the wall to see what would work and what would stick, there was a body of knowledge that we could draw on, which is really critically important. And then the second thing they did was establish these goals. And the first goal was to end chronic homelessness among veterans in 5 years. And they extended the deadline until 2017 by 1 year because they were coming close but not close enough to meet the goal. And this really, setting a national standard like that, demanded that the VA and homeless programs and shelters and police, all folks receiving any kind of federal money, work together in a collaborative way, which is so much harder than it sounds, to really move the needle and establish additional resources for veterans. The second goal was to end chronic homelessness. And then the third goal, which is, I think, the target is 2020, which is to end homelessness among children and families. And I, I can't overstate the impact of having this sort of national think tank at the federal level, but also these benchmarks that then every federal dollar that we receive in the local community, we have to be able to tie that back to one of those national goals and also be able to speak to our capacity to meet programmatic and outcome benchmarks in order to continue to receive the money. It's a kind of rigor that we haven't seen in the homelessness world. And I really believe it's that kind of rigor that has led, gotten us to this place where we can say that we had 206 people who were experiencing homelessness, literal homelessness, in 2013, and that in 2016 we had 156. And so we're making significant progress, and mostly because we're able to be motivated by those goals, but also to use the body of knowledge that they've developed in order to implement good stuff.
What are some of the goals? I mean, I'm assuming that the main goal for TJAC would be to, let's have zero people who are homeless. But there must be other goals that are out there.
So, the Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless seeks to make homelessness rare, brief, and non-recurring in our community. So we don't want very many people to experience homelessness. When they do, we want it to be super brief and solution-focused, and we don't want folks to return to homelessness. And so that's our mission statement and the guiding principle of our community plan to end homelessness. Our goal is to do two things. One, this sort of speaks to this idea of functional zero, which is what the governor had identified around veterans, which is the assumption that the homeless system of care is not solving economic injustice. The homeless system of care is not solving poverty. But the homeless system of care can do two things. One, we can address the backlog of people who are experiencing homelessness, and respond with housing programs and supportive services. And then we can design a system that is super effective, flexible, and fast-acting so that when new people become homeless, we get them out of shelters and into housing within 30 days. And so this is what HUD would identify as a high-performing community. Someone becomes homeless, and we spend some time in shelter. That time that they spend in shelter is they're focused solely on creating some housing stability plans. We get them into a subsidized housing program, whether that's a short-term rental assistance or whether that's long-term support, and within 30 days, so that homelessness really is very, very brief.
You talk about return to homelessness. Is there, are there specific, I guess the phrase that comes to mind is warning signs, but are there specific incidents or behaviors or medical issues that often lead to return to homelessness? Like alcoholism is what immediately pops to mind. I don't know if that's one of them.
Substance abuse addiction is certainly something that exacerbates the condition of homelessness, but by itself, it doesn't cause homelessness. So there's plenty of alcoholics and drug addicts who never become homeless, who at all levels of economic strata in our community.
But once homeless,
it becomes a huge barrier. Absolutely. And for years, we would say we wanted to address the substance abuse addiction before we allowed someone access to a housing resource, which is ridiculous. Because again, you're in a state of crisis. You're responding to your basic needs. You don't have the capacity to struggle with addiction. Which, if anyone's tried to quit smoking or quit drinking or quit using heroin, it's 100% sort of task. You have to have lots of your capacity in order to do that. And if you're focused on where you're going to eat, where you're going to go to the bathroom, or where you're going to shower, whether you're going to spend the night, and whether you're going to be safe there, you don't have the capacity to respond to any of those things, to address any of those things. So that sort of radical shift in our practice has been to adopt what's called a housing first strategy and approach, which is to say we respond to the housing need first, and then we support services for any other kind of change that needs to happen after that. But we don't require behavioral change as a condition of receiving housing assistance. So certainly that's an exacerbating circumstance. But they've done a tremendous amount of, Andrew Greer and Mary Beth Shin, who are national researchers, have done a tremendous amount of research trying to identify what predicts homelessness. And it's next to impossible. So the only true predictor for future homelessness is past homelessness. So once you have become homeless once, the likelihood of becoming homeless again increases dramatically. There are other things like having a family with children under five, or coming from a family of growing up in persistent poverty, or having traumatic history or experience as a child, that certainly increase the likelihood, but none to the extent that they become predictive.
Is that because you were homeless the first time, that shows that you didn't have enough people to fall back on, to reach out to for help, to prevent the first time, so therefore they're probably still not there the second time or the third time?
It could be. Certainly, you know, isolation is one of the hallmarks of homelessness.
Not even isolation, but you may have... burnt your bridges, but I can reach out to my parents because they have the funds.
Right.
You know, you talked about not leaving the area. I don't live in an area with the rest of my family.
Mm-hmm.
But I could reach out to them and they can give me funds so that I wouldn't become homeless.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. So you may not have the resources, and so the social support network that becomes a safety net for other people you may not have because of your previous experience. Either you didn't have it then or you lost it then. I also think that there's sort of a demystification of the homeless process that can happen, where if it's the worst thing that you can imagine happening in your life and it happens and you actually are able to survive it,
wow,
then it's possible that the second time that it happens, you know, you already know that you can survive it. And so there isn't this sort of, it doesn't represent the same kind of barrier. And most people really do resolve homelessness through informal means, right? So 85% of people who receive an eviction notice do not become homeless. And so most of the time people, if you receive an eviction notice, you would assume that that's particularly if you are living in extreme or persistent poverty, you might assume that that would be the outcome. But in fact, 85% of people are able to find an informal arrangement, which while maybe uncomfortable, is far superior to entering the formal system of care for both the humans and for the money, right? So it's way better to work your informal angles. And so there are 15% of those people who don't have an informal network on which to rely, or there's some other thing that means that they're more likely to end up in shelter. And so if we're going to create an effective, high-performing prevention program, we're going to focus on that 15%. And so far, the only thing that we can identify about that 15% is that they probably were homeless before.
11:54 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, learning about homelessness from Khaki Demick. We were talking about, you mentioned earlier about some people not, you know, businesses having homeless folks in front and maybe not, wanting them out of the way because mm-hmm. it's hampering their sales, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There was a lawsuit, Charlottesville Downtown Mall, correct?
Mm-hmm.
What's up with that?
Well, I mean, I think philosophically there is reasonable and healthy tension around the issue of homeless folks in a spot that is attractive to tourists, that is a sort of crown jewel for our city, that is a really vibrant, lovely place for people to visit and for people to spend money. And so the city has an interest in making sure that the downtown mall is thriving. And the city also has an interest in making sure that people who are in need get their needs met. And we don't violate people's civil liberties in order to allow one or the other to occur. And so there is this tension and balance. And you talked about the criminalization of homelessness earlier in the show. And from my money, those are the communities who are tipping the scales too far in one direction. And so I really admire that Charlottesville, both the city, but also the larger system of care, is really trying to figure out what that magic balance is. I love the downtown mall. I'm delighted that the Haven is on the downtown mall where my office is. And so I get a chance to spend time there. It is important to me that it's a vibrant, thriving place. And so I have an interest in its success and survival as well. I also have an interest in the success and survival of the individuals who are in desperate need in our community, and I don't want them to have to go someplace else in order to experience that need. And so finding, striking that balance is really important. And in the end, I believe that that balance comes from individuals talking to other individuals. We claim each other in our community, even though we may have big, strong philosophical differences in the way that we approach each other, but that we acknowledge each other and engage each other in those conversations, even across need.
I was reading that, you know, we're talking about balancing the need in the anti-vagrancy laws that are being met in Birmingham, Alabama, that there was a pastor who was ordered by the police to stop serving hot dogs and bottled water in the park to the homeless.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it really does speak to a moment of a kind of desperation and fear when people get to that, when that kind of spot where you stop caring about the individuals. And it is part of a sort of a broad dehumanization process for people who are in need. And because we know any one of us could be in need of some kind throughout the course of our lives, it's in our best interest to make sure that we create compassionate, loving systems of care, and not systems of care that blame everyone for their need, and then dehumanize them. We have an obligation to our community to take better care of each other.
But there was a lawsuit that just got settled. The Good Samaritan Hospital in Los Angeles just paid out money because a homeless woman in their care was let go on the sidewalk.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's really complicated. If somebody who is experienced and known to be chronically homeless coming to the hospital, presenting to the emergency room to try to get a safe place to spend the night, then you start to characterize them only through that one lens. And then the one day that they show up with a chronic health condition or with something that really would motivate a sort of medical response, you've got this sort of dismissive approach to them. And again, I come back to this issue of dehumanization. You begin to see them only as a cluster of behaviors that you dislike, and you stop to see the human that's involved in the process. It's a huge mistake. But it also is, it takes a tremendous amount of fortitude and patience to not do that, to say, today I'm going to see you afresh, anew, even though every time you come here it seems like you're just trying to be safe overnight. That takes a lot of individual fortitude and systemic fortitude in
help
order to do that.
Tell me the steps to take to do that. When I walk the downtown mall, how do I do that so that I can see somebody and recognize them as not the homeless guy sitting against the wall and asking me if I want to give him some money, but I recognize that person in a state that needs help, even if I don't want to give them the dollar bill in my pocket?
There's nothing more powerful than eye contact, right? And that doesn't mean your eye contact is going to be received with gratitude and love back from somebody. But to make eye contact with someone is to acknowledge their presence, is to count them in the community. Even if you're not smiling, you're just saying, and again, not words, you're just with your eyes, you're saying, I see you. I see you. I see what's happening to you. I can't do anything about it today. I can't change it, but I see you. I claim you. And allow yourself to feel the discomfort that comes with. And I think there's nothing more transformative than that. I believe the same thing when you're faced with a panhandler in the car. Allow yourself to feel the discomfort that you're being reminded that you have something that other people do not.
All right, we're going to finish up and go out with that. Gacky Demick, she's the Executive Director, Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for coming in. Next week, we'll be talking about the muzzles. Thanks for being with us.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.